It sounds like the most boring topic in existence, and it sounds terrifying and technical and complicated.
Have you ever wondered how information gets from A to B without wires? How does a call get from your friend's cell phone to yours? The data from the net to your laptop at the local coffee shop, the clicks of your game controller to your game system, or just the simple old-fashioned voices on your radio. All of this information travels wirelessly using Spectrum, that magical highway in the sky that carries all of our bits from device to device. But as more and more wirelessly enabled devices hit the market, from baby monitors to cell phones to wireless routers, we need to get more creative about how that spectrum is used. That's the argument of today's guest, who says we need to update how we understand spectrum, from the dumb days of the 20th century to the smart device-enabled 21st. Christian Sandvig is a Berkman Fellow and directs the Project on Public Policy and Advanced Communication Technology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listen in as he gives David Weinberger a tour through the magical world of spectrum.
If you go up to someone at a cocktail party and you tell them that you work on the electromagnetic spectrum, they are terrified. It sounds like the most boring topic in existence, and it sounds terrifying and technical and complicated.
But possibly that you're admitting that you are a robotic form of life.
That's right, or a physicist or something. Like, it's not clear what it means, right? But spectrum is simple. The word spectrum is a noun, and it refers to a range. And the most common way that we use it, and we do usually understand it, is in the phrase the political spectrum. So the political spectrum is a range, and it's usually a range of opinion from the right to left, and that right to left comes from the seating arrangements in the French National Assembly, historically, who sat on the right and who sat on the left. So when you talk about the electromagnetic spectrum, you're talking about a range, and again, it has a right and left, but instead of being about political opinion, it's about wavelength, which is, again, a scary word, right? You see it all over the place, like microwave and shortwave and wave. But in fact, wavelength just means the frequency with which you transmit. And again, frequency has acquired a kind of scary scientific air when you talk about radio, but it just means, you know, how often. So that's basically what frequency is. So when we talk about the electromagnetic spectrum, we're just talking about a range of radio signals. And so this is the really confusing thing, because people think that there are all these other parts to the spectrum that they need to understand, like channels and, you know, all kinds of things to do with like how the transmitters work or how the receivers work or how the antennas work. But these are all man-made sort of after-the-fact additions. The basic of the electromagnetic spectrum is just a range.
So when you say frequency, how often you transmit, you don't mean that you're on once a week or once a day. You're referring to the frequency of the electromagnetic waves.
That's true, but I mean, really, conceptually, it's the same as if you were saying whether you're on once a week or once a day. It's just much faster. So, yes, I'm referring to something in the radio, but you mean you could think of it in exactly the same way. So, I mean, the thing that's interesting about the spectrum is that we've separated all of our transitions by frequency, and people who use old radios, back when radios had dials, you know, in their car, they know what this is because
there's... I like to call them real radios.
You know, that's
right. Go ahead, you young whippersnapper.
That's right. So with real radios, you had frequency numbers on the dial, and you would tune the radio by turning the dial to what frequency number, right? But in fact, this is all a kind of man-made addendum and, you know, tacked onto the spectrum that makes it the way that we've decided to use it. But what's confusing is we've taken that to be the permanent state of nature, that there's something about the spectrum that means it has to be divided that way, whereas there isn't, in fact. So Marconi, when he first was doing radio experiments, did not understand frequency at all. And so to him, it was like everything was one channel. There was no way to tune, really. He just thought that it was one big thing. And you could, in fact, think about radio that way. And so how you think about it, how you approach the use of radio is actually as important as, say, the physics of electromagnetics, right? And so what's confusing for people about radio, which is probably a safer and, you know, less alarming word for the electromagnetic spectrum, is that so much of it is man-made. So much of it is social and legal and not particularly about physics. Like, there are physics in there and there's technical stuff in there, but usually the engineers are changing the devices in order to suit what they think that the people want or what the institutions desire, what the laws say. And so it's so much social that people don't understand this.
So there's a wave that physicists can study that has an amplitude and it has a frequency of the pulses, which we've all seen on, even if it's just sci-fi, on oscilloscopes or whatever, that sort of representation of a wave. That's real, but what we choose to use it for and how we choose to generate them and then the law and policy around that is clearly human stuff, not right. physics stuff.
That's right. I mean, another way to think about it is to say that sometimes in people who work in radio, there's a phrase, the useful spectrum, which is the subset of the electromagnetic spectrum or of radio waves that we can figure out how to use. And it's changing all the time because people are figuring out new ways to use radio, new kinds of antennas, new kinds of transmitters, new kinds of receivers. In fact, the whole space of radio is this sort of constantly changing thing that is really a lot more about sort of what the engineers are doing and what they think that the people want, the kinds of devices they're designing for people to use, than it is about the physics. So again, going back to old televisions this time, I mean, many older people will remember that televisions, you know, used to have to be tuned and they had a smaller number of channels, right? And then as the useful spectrum got bigger, in part because of law and policy, not physics, the physics didn't change. You got, you know, you went to UHF and all of a sudden televisions had more channels on them and they were tuned differently and they had different antennas. And this has been our experience of the spectrum is we keep figuring out new things to do with it. And so we keep adding to the space in the useful spectrum. But one of the confusing things is that it seems to people as though the way we've always used the spectrum is somehow permanent. They confuse some of the conventions that we've evolved for something to do with physics. And so the debates that we have about spectrum, say in the government or at the FCC, have a very technical air and are very exclusive. Outsiders don't usually participate in them because they're filled with jargon and it's very terrifying. But in fact, what you're talking about in these debates is very basic sort of normative and social questions about what kinds of things do people want out of radio, out of wireless? You know, would it be better to have more radio stations or more television stations? Would it be better to have television that was sharper and had higher resolution?
So let's take as an example the notion of channels. And if you grew up in the old TV tuner days, as some of us did, you thought that there were 13 channels in, it was VHF, I guess, because that's how high your tuner went.
Right.
But channels are not themselves a physical
right.
object.
No, absolutely.
Channels reflect the capabilities of the technology.
Uh-huh.
So what's a channel in the old days, anyway?
In fact, a channel, you could say, is a kind of convention. Like, it's a way of dividing this not particularly naturally divisible thing, the electromagnetic spectrum. Remember, a range. So it's a way of dividing the range into parts, the way we might say this person is a conservative and this other person is an ultra-conservative. And where exactly you divide the line, isn't actually found in the nature of conservatism. It's something that you're adding on. So in earlier radio, the channels were the way that we figured out to transmit so that more than one person could do it. So a metaphor for channels that sometimes people like is to think about roads. So you could think of a road, if you wanted to think of the electromagnetic spectrum as a road, then the channels are the lanes. And so we say that, you know, your truck is going to go in this lane, and this is going to be the bicycle lane, and this is going to be the regular lane for cars, and this prevents all of the cars and bicycles and trucks from running into each other.
These lanes are not passable. You're not allowed to change lanes at any point.
That's right.
That's the whole reason they were established.
Absolutely.
So channel in this architecture would be a range, a bit of the spectrum,
right.
Going from one frequency to another,
right.
That is dedicated to a particular broadcaster, mm-hmm. the way that the bicycle lane might be dedicated to bicycles or to a particular bicyclist.
Right.
And the size of the channels, how many we can fit within some designated usable spectrum range,
uh-huh.
Was and is, I suppose, determined by how finely grained the equipment that we're using, the receivers and the transmitters, are for interpreting the frequencies that are assigned to them.
That's right. I mean, in fact, if you think about it, if you're an engineer and your job, again, going with this metaphor of lanes and roads, if you're an engineer and your job, when you start your job, you sit down and your boss says to you, your job is to design a car that never changes lanes, then you'll do that. And the car will get better and better at it, right? But if you started with a different metaphor, if it was possible for you to start with a different sort of arrangement, instead, if you were said, we're going to think of, we don't have the idea of lanes. Instead, there's just going to be a mass of people and your job is to not run into them. Then you would design something very different. So the assumptions, you know, that going in and how you think about the spectrum actually interact quite a bit with the kinds of devices and tools and services that you get at the other end. Another way that people have thought about the spectrum, if you like the road metaphor, is that they've said that it's more like a train switching yard, because in train switching yard, instead of lanes, you have tracks, and it's hard to switch tracks. So that, you know, it better fits the idea that it's, you get one device and it's on a channel, and it, you know, it's hard for it to switch to another channel, right? So one track you might think of as television or a television station, a television channel, another radio, but then you've got baby monitors, you've got air traffic control, you've got you know, medical telemetry, you've got radio astronomy. All these things are sort of tracks, right? So the way that spectrum's been evolving in this rail switching yard, we've kept adding tracks because we figured out how to make more and more frequencies available. This is what you said earlier when you said we got VHF after UHF and television got more channels. So we keep adding tracks because we can design devices that use different frequencies.
But in every case, still in general, the devices that we're designing, the literal radios and literal
yep.
TVs,
yeah.
Work... because they expect that built into the technology is the notion that a channel that you want to get continuous broadcast, you want to keep listening to the same song,
right,
or whatever. Mm-hmm. The technology expects that a channel will exist at the same frequency, and all it has to do is stay locked on that frequency, and it will get the song from start to finish.
Absolutely.
And if you have a lane-changing metaphor, then the technology has to be different as well.
Yeah. So in fact, the way we used to implement channels is that you would have a piezoelectric crystal in your radio and it would be tuned. And basically, if you wanted to switch out of a frequency that the crystal was tuned to, you would throw away the radio. That was the way you would retune it. I mean, maybe the radio would have the crystal would have a range that you could adjust with a dial, but you couldn't go out of the range. And so this is a weird kind of irreversibility in spectrum policy, in radio policy, because whenever you decided to have a particular service do a particular thing, like here's a wireless microphone, or here's a radio station, or here's a cellular phone, then you were pretty much locked into not using that differently until all of those devices stopped working.
Given that that's how our technology has been since radios and TVs have been around, we have a set of social and legal structures that are based around that idea of channels. Mm-hmm. How does the technological commitment to channels show up in governmental social policy?
Well, in fact, I think that the issue is really not how channels show up in policy, but rather that we have some new capabilities now that call into question the idea of channels. It's not, you know, channels were for a while a really useful convenience that helped us build radios and understand how to separate services. But now it looks like we might not want them.
But we also have, for example, an FCC that auctions off mm-hmm. Channels,
right.
Frequency, ranges,
that's right. Yeah.
And then we have massive communications companies that pay unimaginable amounts of money mm-hmm. to win the auctions, to own the channels.
Right.
And so there is baked into,
yes.
not just into the physics, mm-hmm. It's not baked into the physics, but it's baked into the governmental and economic system, mm-hmm. As well as into our traditional technology, a commitment to channels.
You know, Harold Feld memorably called spectrum auctions the crack cocaine of public policy. I mean, spectrum auctions are the crack cocaine of public policy. It's a way that the government earns, as you say, huge amounts of money for the treasury. And so it's very difficult to imagine a sort of governmental scenario without spectrum auctions now, because they raise so much money. And so this is, again, as you say, not locked into physics. It doesn't have to do with what's most efficient. It has to do with the fact that we've evolved an institutional system that depends on multi-billion-dollar sort of revenues from spectrum auctions.
So what's going on in the world of technology that will allow channel-less radio and TV and other forms of transmission?
Well, if we think about the radio spectrum, again, as this this train switching yard where everyone's locked onto a track and it's hard to switch tracks, and the tracks are the channels. So if we think about the yard this way, there's some funny things that immediately appear. And one is that some channels are full of trains all the time. So like the television station is transmitting 24 hours a day. In the distant past, it didn't used to do that. There were used to be television stations that didn't, but now they're all full. Trains are always running on those tracks. So there's no way that you can, you know, slip an extra train in there because they're always running. If you turn on the TV, there's something on the television channel all the time. But other tracks are mostly empty. So the tracks that, say, are used by taxi cab drivers to communicate with their base to pick up a new fare, or the tracks that are used by some kinds of telemetry or other things, in fact, are mostly empty. The trains come by very infrequently, and most of the channel is actually not used. So now technologies have evolved that are nimble enough that they don't actually behave, or they don't need to behave, like trains on tracks. Mainly spurred by research by the Defense Department, which was concerned about frequencies for reasons that you would imagine. So if you're, for example, say you're invading a country, you don't want to be using the same frequencies as the army you're opposing. You need to come up with some sort of radio system that will allow you to evade their attempts to jam you. They have to be really nimble in what channel or frequency they're using. So if you take the work that's been done primarily by the defense industry in new applications or new kinds of devices for the spectrum, you have devices that behave a lot more like the railroad workers. So how do the railroad workers behave in the yard? I mean, they sort of wear a reflective orange vest and a hard hat, and they walk around, and they don't take any notice of the tracks. They're not on tracks. They're on feet. They walk around wherever they need to. And since trains, you know, move in the yard about, you know, 5 miles an hour, it's not really that big a deal for them to get around the trains. They just walk where there aren't any trains. When they see a train, they move around it. And they're not actually on channels at all, or whatever channel they're on, they don't take any notice of particularly. And so it's now possible to think of radio this way, that you could design radio systems that didn't need to take into account for channels. They would say, listen to see what channels or tracks were free, and use those, or not particularly be bothered by tracks or channels. And just to be clear, this is revolutionary because it turns this huge institution, this 100-year institution of the radio spectrum and its regulation and its policy and its industry, onto a different sort of footing if you suddenly don't need channels, because everything is organized around channels.
So this would enable more efficient use of the usable spectrum.
Yes, but this is a political decision, again, as to who you allow into the rail yard. Like, who gets to have these radios and what are they going to be used for? Again, not about physics. It's about, you know, normative decisions we make about who ought to have the ability to transmit and where and for what.
And what the protocols or rules of behavior, the information, the waves need... Well, not the waves, but the transmitters and receivers need to follow, so that they're not all, for example, by accident, broadcasting on exactly the same railway track.
Yeah,
they need to be able
absolutely.
To sense and move around, mm-hmm. which is stuff that needs to be, as I understand it, needs to be resolved at this point.
Yeah, I mean, another way to think about this that I find very helpful is that we're at kind of a crisis of metaphor in the electromagnetic spectrum, because, I mean, really, radio is not something that you and I physically experience particularly. I mean, the closest I can think of is that if you have a radio, as in my car, and you touch it with your hand, sometimes the signal changes, so you bodily experience electromagnetism because you are the antenna when you touch the face of the radio. But mostly, these are invisible things, and we have no particular sense of them. We have to use these devices to understand them. And so we use metaphors. And so I've been using the train metaphor. People use road metaphors. Maxwell, famous for Maxwell's equations, used the metaphor of gears, which is really not that intuitive to us now. But that's partly because we use metaphors that fit the time that we're living in. And gears were perhaps more intuitive, you know, at the turn of the Industrial Revolution. But now the metaphors we mostly use for spectrum are water. And to some degree, clouds. So, for example, in engineering textbooks, when they try to teach students about radio in the beginning of radio, they used a pond. And they said, imagine a pond and you have a float on the pond. And you want to move the float up and down like a buoy. And then you want another float to move up and down in sympathy. So it's not that hard. You just move the float that you control up and down, and then as the waves move out, they start to vibrate the other float. And that's radio, according to this textbook, right? And then they wanted to explain interference, and they said, imagine that you have two floats and you move them up and down. Well, then it's not clear what the third float is going to get, because some of the waves will collide, cancel each other out. Maybe the third float will move to the first or the second. You're not really sure how it will work. And that's interference. The problem is that this is a metaphor. It's not actually interference. It's not actually how the electromagnetic spectrum works. We had an idea that the spectrum worked like that when we called it ether, which was a word for an invisible fluid that no one could see. But in fact, the spectrum isn't an invisible fluid. So just even though this is a confusing area, I mean, let's make it clear. Waves in the electromagnetic spectrum don't collide because there is no fluid. So in fact, if you have a radio receiver that's smart enough to listen to more than one set of waves at the same time, this is now possible, whereas before it wasn't. It's not that the waves crash against each other and cancel each other out. These are systems, and how we understand them really depends upon all of the parts, and it's not something as simple as sort of waves that run into each other. But still, it's very difficult to understand how to conceptualize this new thinking in radio, and that's important because, as we've said, it's policymakers and institutions that are making these decisions about radio, and so we need some way to explain what's going on, and we don't actually have a good way right now.
What constitutes a good way? Metaphors, each metaphor calls out something that's true enough about the phenomenon. This is why we use it. Is there such a thing as a right metaphor that isn't right because it supports a particular technology or policy?
The internet is a good metaphor for the future of radio. Because on the internet, say you're listening to a podcast, maybe this podcast, if you're listening to this podcast, you didn't tune anything in any particular way. Like, it's true that there is a kind of pipe or a range or something that's conveying this podcast to you, and that in fact that is subdivided. But the way it's subdivided, you don't need to know about. You don't need to know if it's by time or if it's by channel. I mean, in fact, on the internet, we do use things that are sort of like channels for convenience, but we haven't, you know, like ports. But we haven't really institutionalized them to such a degree that we auction them off from the FCC or anything like that.
Nor have we made them obvious to users.
Exactly. That's right.
Generally, almost always have no idea what port
absolutely
the information is going through. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, the packets are behaving that constitute the internet transmission units are behaving much more like your railway workers than they are behaving like the trains.
Absolutely. So, I mean, a broader question about this is that, as you say, what's the new metaphor? I'm not sure that the internet is all of it, but is there some way that we can take what we know about systems that behave in this new way and use it to show people that this something else is possible? So Kevin Werbach is an example of this because he's written about how we can take Wi-Fi, which is something that now is universally almost loved and used. It's a very, very common wireless technology. And yet it doesn't work in the way that we normally think of channels as working, right? Because Wi-Fi, you don't need to go to the FCC and buy a license. I mean, they wouldn't say buy, but there it is. You don't need to win an auction. You can just go to Best Buy or Radio Shack and get a Wi-Fi device at airport, or you just buy a laptop and, you know, it's in there. But you have a radio station. I mean, make no doubt about it. Just when you buy a baby monitor or a cordless phone, you have a radio station. So with Wi-Fi, what we're doing is we're allowing people to transmit without advance permission from the government. There is a frequency division there. So Wi-Fi is only allowed to use a certain sort of slice or channel. But in fact,
which is why it can stop working. You can get kicked off the page you're on when your phone rings or your microwave starts up, depending on what channels you're using.
That's right. But again, I mean, Wi-Fi actually uses a bunch of channels called sub-channels, and we don't make the user particularly care about this. And it's built into the technology that if I and my neighbor both have a wireless access point, we don't particularly ever have to get together about it, nor do we have to ask the FCC for any help. Kevin Werbach had an interesting proposition several years ago, and he said, what if everything were like Wi-Fi? I mean, what if, you know, you bought transmitters and the transmitters figured out where exactly to go? I mean, maybe like smarter Wi-Fi or more like Wi-Fi augmented with some new technology from the Defense Department. What if everything were unlicensed and everything, maybe it had channels, maybe it didn't, but you didn't have to worry about it and it didn't have to be agreed upon in advance. So this is some of the research I've been doing for the past several years as part of a project funded by the National Science Foundation. And that's to say, what if we use Wi-Fi, which is a technology that we have now and that it works and it's not strictly controlled into channels in advance at all. And we try to reason about what future radio systems might look like on the basis of what happens with Wi-Fi right now. And again, it's not a perfect comparison in many dimensions, but at least it's an interesting idea because certainly Wi-Fi looks a lot different than channels or tuning a radio dial or television channels, for example.
So which aspect, when you say like Wi-Fi, which aspects of Wi-Fi? Does Wi-Fi do the sort of frequency hopping? That is, the transmitter and the receiver figure out what's the optimal frequency to be broadcasting on at this moment, to be interacting on at this moment, given the traffic around them, so they can change from one to another.
You could say that they do, but very slowly. So now the new Wi-Fi devices will do things, particularly the access points, they will do this very, very slow, once maybe in their life, listening and then choosing a channel. So you could say that they do. It's just that they do it very, very slowly. We might not call it frequency hopping, but they do listen and then choose. And that's a newer feature of these devices. They didn't used to do it.
So when you say, imagine if everything were like Wi-Fi, is that the feature or one of the features that you're looking at, or is it some other set of features?
Well, one of the key things about Wi-Fi that might make it interesting in this case is that the objections that people have had to just treating everyone like a rail yard worker instead of like a train is that you would quickly fill the rail yard with people and then no one would be able to move because there would be too many people and not enough space. This dates back to something called the broadcast wars in the United States. Which were basically a situation where, because licensing of radio was not well advanced, too many people were trying to transmit, and that there were no penalties for interference in some cases, and so it was a viable commercial motive, a sort of commercial strategy to try to basically jam your competitors, and so. For a period, historians tell us that there's a period in the United States where no radio worked because you could say that there were tracks, but that there were no rules about who got what track. And so everyone tried to use all the tracks and nothing could ever be heard. So one of the objections to doing some sort of future new kind of spectrum allocation is that, you know, if we let the computers just work it out somehow and the people can buy the computers without advance permission, everything will quickly fill up. So Wi-Fi is a really nice comparison there because anyone can, in fact, buy a Wi-Fi access point or a computer with Wi-Fi, and these have been very popular. And so it's very interesting to say, well, how can we reason about this if we know that there's no limit on Wi-Fi? When does Wi-Fi stop working? When does Wi-Fi get so full that no one can use it anymore?
Wi-Fi operates within some very small bands of frequency. And one of the proposals is for an open spectrum policy.
Yep.
That says take some, most, or all, depending who you talk with, of the allocated, auctioned off spectrum and free that up for technologies like Wi-Fi or for smart radios or cognitive radios,
right,
which are capable of doing the negotiation on demand to switch from this to that so that the spectrum is used as efficiently as possible. Is that what you're looking at? And do you think there's any hope for open spectrum?
I mean, I think the obstacles are really political and institutional. I mean, some have said the National Association of Broadcasters is the most powerful lobby in Washington. I've also heard the AARP is. I'm not sure what to believe, not being a lobbyist or a politician, but the fact is that we currently have a very wealthy industrial base that's very dedicated to the arrangements that we have now. So when we've improved our technologies for wireless, this has been translated through our political system into actually giving more to the industries that already have it. So, for example, when we have advances that make, say, television more efficient, our response into how to use them is not to, say, allow more people to have television stations. It's been mostly to allow the people that already have television stations to have more channels, or to allow the television stations that already exist to have a higher resolution. And so this is, again, a political decision and not something about something technical about the electromagnetic spectrum. So I would say that the prospects technically are very good, but the prospects politically are very poor. But let me say more about this this comparison to Wi-Fi, because I think this is interesting. So one of the objections that you hear quite often about the proposal that you just outlined about, you know, having a more open spectrum where everything looked more like a computer that would just choose whatever frequencies it wanted, is that this is, again, a problem of reversibility. If you let all these devices out there and too many people use them, it's not that easy to figure out how to call them back. And in fact, if everything gets filled and nothing works, it's the FCC that passed this rule that gets blamed. I mean, you could say their reason for existence is to ensure that everything is nice and predictable in the electromagnetic spectrum and that there is no broadcast war that ever happens again. And so it can be challenging even for a rational policymaker who might endorse the idea of a more flexible use of spectrum to say that this is a good idea, because it seems somewhat dangerous and uncontrollable, because you're not sure how many people will buy these devices or what they'll be used for when you move away from this idea of channels, where we say, here's a track, you're allowed to use it for this, and only you. So one of the things my research has been doing is to try to look at people who use Wi-Fi and say, how exactly can we predict in advance where Wi-Fi will become congested, not using anything we know about wireless, but using what we know about people. So let me give you an example. Anyone in Wi-Fi, anyone can go to Radio Shack and buy a radio station that's called, you know, a Wi-Fi access point, right? But, realistically, we know that people aren't randomly distributed around the United States. And so if we wanted to have something like a map of who was likely to fill this particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum, we could make some good guesses about it. And engineers already do this. They usually say, well, where the people are, that's where the wireless signals will be generated. And that's pretty crude, because, you know, all people aren't the same.
10 years ago, the New York Times did a map of Wi-Fi hotspots in New York City, and it was basically a map, a socioeconomic map of New York City.
Exactly, so, right. Yeah, and in fact, social science understands this kind of thing really well. We can do a pretty good job of predicting who is going to use a particular technology. I mean, maybe it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than saying, where there are people, there will be wireless. And some of it's actually not as obvious as you might think. Like, you might say, oh, well, people with more money will be more likely to buy these newfangled computer things. And that's true. But in fact, when you add another variable, so age, for example, then it gets more complicated, right? Because older people tend to have more money, but the older you get, there's this sort of drop off in how likely you are to buy the newfangled computer thing. And let's add another variable. Let's say whether you're a student or not. Well, as it happens, students behave as though they have much higher a socioeconomic status than they do. Or you could say that they do have higher socioeconomic status, but that's in potential earnings and how they feel about themselves and not in actual earnings. They may not have that much money, but they act like they do when they're a student. So students actually behave like richer people, right? And then if you start taking these variables and adding them together, it becomes actually very difficult to say whether a given person is going to do a particular thing or not, because it's just too many variables to quickly reason it out, and some of them contradict others. We could take historical examples. Pagers were particularly popular in some subcultures, totally disproportionate to a simple rule like, if you have more money, you're going to want the latest technology. So in fact, a colleague, Nalini Kodamraju, gave a great paper about how plumbers, pediatricians, and pimps and pushers were the particular segments that were more likely to adopt pagers. So we can reason about this. So as a part of this research, what I did is I sent graduate students to drive around different neighborhoods of Chicago and also some small towns in Illinois and L.A., and I asked them to look at who was using Wi-Fi, and then we used the demographics that are in the U.S. Census for those neighborhoods to try and come up with a model of, is it possible to predict in advance what kinds of Wi-Fi use you'll see for a given neighborhood. And this is the same thing you do, basically, when you open your laptop. So when you open your laptop, you see a little list of available access points in the upper right corner if it's a Mac. And that's what my students were doing, basically, but with some more sinister-looking equipment that got them pulled over by the police several times. They just had a big sort of antenna out the window. So then after we drive around these neighborhoods, we come up with a model, and it turns out it works really well. So I have a game that I made up to popularize this that works a little bit like, do you know the carnival games Guess Your Weight?
Sure.
Yeah. So what's fun about that game, correct me if I've got this wrong.
Nothing's fun about it, so I'm already correcting you, but keep going.
but the reason it's interesting is that you don't think if it's fair, we assume it's not rigged. If it's fair, the carnival barker who guesses your weight, you wouldn't think he would be able to guess your weight given the limited information of what you look like. I mean, especially if you wear baggy clothes or something. So that's what's interesting about it. So we're doing the same thing with Wi-Fi. We're saying, tell me your address, and I'll guess your Wi-Fi. And you wouldn't think I would be able to guess your Wi-Fi based on your address, but in fact, I do a pretty good job. And the reason is that I look up the demographics in the census that apply to that address, and then I apply this model predicting who will use Wi-Fi. So in the broader picture, the reason this is interesting is that it's telling us that if we had an apparently crazy and chaotic, you know, at first glance, system of using the spectrum where everyone was a railroad worker and could run around whatever they want, it's not actually chaotic. It's actually very predictable. We can come up with predictions like, we'll have congestion on this band in this year because this is how we see people using this technology, and then we can mitigate that. So it's just a different kind of certainty. I mean, it's not the certainty of passing a law about channels and saying that we're going to fine you if you use a channel that we didn't approve. Instead, we're saying we're going to model how we expect people to behave and to sort of have a spectrum observatory that guesses what the future of the spectrum will be. But still, we can have some certainty about how the future of the spectrum will be used based on these kinds of studies.
There's at least one other element of this, which has to do with making sure that the railway workers, the radio wave information that's trying to get through, behaves in a way that optimizes the system overall, rather than optimizes their own chances to be heard. So, for example, if in one of these systems, the two ends of the system sense that channels are getting congested, one possible strategy for a selfish broadcaster is, I'll just broadcast more and more. I'll do it louder and louder, and I'll flood as much because it's a better chance that mine will get through. But that's, of course, especially if everybody does that, it's disastrous for the system. An alternative is for the channel, the broadcaster, to say, there's no available frequency. I'm going to back off and wait. I'm going to check every whatever the interval is, but not very often, and then I'll broadcast. That minimizes its chances for success, but increases the system's efficiency, and thus, in a way, increases its own efficiency as well, its own chances. What I'm saying is that in addition to predicting congestion through the very clever research that you're doing, a set of protocols or behaviors for that was agreed upon by all participants should also do a great deal to yield a maximally efficient system.
Yes, and this is another great example of how it's useful to learn from Wi-Fi. So in the Wi-Fi research, one of the things that I did is to visit wireless internet service providers around the country and in actually a few other English-speaking countries and talk to them about how they were providing service. Because completely acknowledging and agreeing with your point, I thought, gosh, if it's true that, you know, you are competing with someone else, you're a wireless internet service provider, a WISP they call them, and you have a competitor that's doing the same thing, why not jam them? I mean, technically in these countries, intent, you know, jamming with intent would be illegal, but in unlicensed spectrum, it's not really clear that, you know, that there's no way to enforce that particularly. It's not easy to enforce in many countries. So in fact, if you talk to these wireless internet service providers, you would expect some of the behavior that David, you just proposed, that they would in fact be trying to push their competitors out by, say, pushing their traffic onto their channels, onto their other signals. And that's what we found. In fact, we found some wireless ISPs that were jamming each other for business reasons in the unlicensed spectrum. I don't think it's insoluble, though. I mean, you can just... I mean, all depends on what kinds of rules you put in the devices. So it's perfectly possible that you can design the devices to at least minimize most of this behavior. And then, which is not really the way we think about radios now, but it could be a way we think about radios. One of the findings of the research that I think is quite interesting is that, engineers at a private company like a WISP may not really be very good at managing spectrum. I mean, the government has actually pushed a lot of spectrum management onto consumers and businesses that now we never used to see. So we've been kind of going in the opposite trend that I'm suggesting. We've been forcing people to know more and more about frequencies and channels. I mean, just go down to Best Buy and try to buy a cordless phone. And on the box, there's all kinds of jargon that you never used to have to see about, 900 megahertz this or 2.4 gigahertz that, and this kind of protocol versus that. It's decked, it's not. So I think the way forward is actually to encapsulate more of this expertise in the protocols and the devices so that you don't have as much of a possibility for the people operating these networks, whether they're, consumers or, say, engineers for a wireless internet service provider, to take advantage of some of the openness in the system in the way that you propose.
That and some new metaphors.
Right.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Christian Sandvig is a Berkman Fellow, and he directs the Project on Public Policy and Advanced Communication Technology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He lives on the web at niftyc.org. That's niftyc.org. You can find out more about Christian on our blog, including links to his recent work and an awesome video of a panel he just moderated at this year's RaffleCon. Just visit us at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode was produced by me with David Weinberger at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.